Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, we're just trying to connect with Tony the Tornado here, and Psychic Tom will probably pop in a minute. Sorry about the late start for all you live listeners out there. We, as always, have a little technical difficulties, probably because of the rain here. But we'll get underway shortly. We're going to have a quick hit short show tonight. Run down the boxing and MMA news and schedules. And we're going to introduce a couple new segments, so get to know your host a little bit better here. All right. We got the whole crew together, I think, right?
All right, Rich. I'm here.
All right. So we're getting a little bit of a late start tonight, but what's new, right? It seems like we got clear sailing here anyway. So one thing I definitely wanted to address right off the bat, so I kind of get it off my chest, is this whole card from last Saturday, which I didn't even watch myself, unfortunately. UFC 149. With all kinds of different cancellations of bouts due to injury, and it led a lot of people to say the event was cursed, and the event comes up, and it's not the kind of dynamic fights that were expected, even of the people that didn't cancel. And I don't know, Tom, I guess I have to rely on your thoughts to make a more educated bit of commentary on it, but I only watched the Boach fight, and I didn't think it was all that bad. And what did you think of some of the other fights?
Well, I think it wasn't so much, I don't know, my frustration with the card came down to, first off, I think that we were both on the money about Congo. Well, see, Congo, you know, that the fact that he never really has been the same. And I think that, my God, what a snooze fest that one was. You know,
I did read about some comments from Dana White saying this isn't the ultimate clinching championships.
And I think that in that one, my frustration was that with Jordan, you know, sometimes you have the problem of not knowing what to do. And you see that with a lot of new guys. But when you get to this level, you would expect him to have a game plan. So then it gets down to he either couldn't implement it or it was a conditioning issue. It just absolute hard to even put it into words. I was so let down by that. Well, so, and as far as, you know, as far as Boach, how did you feel about the decision?
I thought it could have gone either way, you know, but it was definitely smart game plan by Boach, and you know, whether the right Hector Lombard showed up or not, I don't know. I mean, it just doesn't. Looking at his record, I haven't really watched a lot of his fights, but looking at his record and how many times in the last, I think, 10 or so fights that he's just finished guys before the third round is up. You know, he seems to always finish guys one way or another. It was very weird to see him. But kept the right distance himself, and I didn't even think it was that bad a fight. I mean, sure, it wasn't knockout or submit. You know, it wasn't decided that way, but you can still have a good decision. You know, it's a co-main event, and you know, there's big expectations on this Lombard guy's shoulders, but doesn't mean it wasn't a good fight.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, what really pissed me off was reading Dana White's commentary, and I know we talked about this after UFC 148 when he talked about how Forrest Griffin and Tito Ortiz looked old. Well, Ortiz is getting ready to retire, and Griffin has to rely on TRT just to compete these days. So,
yeah,
you know, obviously they are old, number one. And number two, he ought to just shut up and defend some of these guys. I mean, they're most of them, they're not getting paid nearly as much as boxers. And a lot of them, just to get to the UFC, they have to almost pay out of their own pockets to make it through all these other leagues and you know, survive in this MMA business. So I think White should appreciate that a little bit more and stick up for some of these fighters and events. I mean, he's a promoter. I understand people like to hear what he has to, like to hear him tell it like it is and, you know, admit his faults and all that, and the, I mean, the business's faults, but it comes to a point where he just sounds like a little brat, you know? It's expecting so much and getting so little back, and he's having a little temper tantrum over it.
Yeah.
And he should just go out there before the cameras and say, listen, this is mixed martial arts, you know, this is not pro wrestling. There's no script. We can't go out there and manufacture exciting fights. It is what it is. You know, if you want to criticize that, fine. Maybe the fights weren't that dynamic, but these guys fought their asses off.
Well, it goes back to that old Larry Merchant saying about boxing, how boxing is the theater of the unexpected.
Yeah.
Like you said, you can't really script this stuff. But as far as Hector specifically, you know, you have that syndrome of guys in baseball that all through the minor leagues they're just doing great, and then they come to the majors and they realize it's a whole nother game. Now, could it have been that syndrome, or could it have been just an off night or first time UFC jitters? I don't know. You know, that's the fascinating question. I think if I'm Dana, I would want to see him again before I'd write him off.
All right.
Let me add something to this real quick. Speaking of what Tom was just saying about the first time UFC jitters, I'm going to mention a professional boxer, and you may have heard of him. In his first world title fight, I'm going back to around the late 90s, or it might have been like 97, 98, I don't remember the exact year. The champion was a guy by the name of Freddie Norwood. They called him a little haggler, I think, because he, you know, fearless Freddie or something like that. Tough little fighter. You know, he was talented, and he was fighting a challenger. And the challenger completely spunked out the joint. He was atrocious. You could just tell he was not mentally ready for that fight. And I think it either ended in a disqualification or a decision. I don't remember, but I know Fearless Freddie kept his title. And this challenger was bashed for performing so poorly. And I think he turned around and had a okay career. Have you ever heard of Juan Manuel Marquez?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and that name rings a bell. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
So a very good point. And so I don't think one night should wreck a career, but I think there was so much hype, so much buildup. And it also begs the question, are we having too many events too quick? And is Dana concerned that if we have enough cards like this, it's going to eventually start to affect the pay-per-view numbers? That's a possibility also.
Right.
You know,
well, it's kind of funny because I read this little fluff piece over on Bleacher Report the other day about how, you know, should Dana White take a step back with the headline? And, you know, the author was obviously trying to suck up and keep his access to Dana White because he didn't even really give the con to the pros. Not a single con as far as, you know, yeah, he's too outspoken and you know, too rude about some of this stuff, and, you know, just doesn't come across as professional in a lot of situations. But anyway, the guy's argument was basically, well, he already has taken a step back because he's starting to take vacations now. He took a 2-week vacation to Australia, so that means he's already taken a step back.
Got it.
And
got it.
I was just like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, and this guy gets paid to write for that site. So, and he's like the UFC expert. I'm like,
yeah.
You know, I couldn't think of a dumber piece to put together and try to justify as journalism. But, you know, it kind of made me think, you know, what is this whole UFC thing with people saying all the time that Dana White has done such great things for the sport. And, you know, he's always getting these people, whether they want more access or they just, you know, they don't want to get written off or whatever. All these people that say that Dana White has contributed so much to this sport, they never provide examples. What has he in particular done other than be a mouthpiece and fly around the country and talk to people all the time about, or around the world actually, about the UFC? You know, what else has he really done personally?
Well,
can somebody give me an example?
Okay. Let's go back in time to SEG, when SEG was running the show with Meyerowitz. And you remember the late 90s, if you were a fan back then. And I remember when, I think it was 97, when we lost cable, lost all access to cable. And at that point, the sport's on its deathbed. And somehow, maybe Dana was just in the right place at the right time, and he had a couple rich friends, convinced them to buy it, convinced them to keep it going, was able to put the show on Spike. Okay, so up until, say, 2005, 2006, he did quite a bit in that sense. Or am I wrong?
All that stuff is true, of course, but he was actually against the reality show on Spike to begin with. And it was the Fertittas who actually were the brain children for that whole idea, because they had a show called American Casino. And it was all about their inner doings at the station casinos out there in Las Vegas and how these brothers were running it. I never actually saw that show, but I do remember seeing clips of it. You know, that was their first experience with reality TV, and they enjoyed it. So they were able to cultivate something out of that with the UFC once they bought it. But I mean, people underestimate too, just because the Fertittas are kind of private people, and they usually take the background angle, except for Lorenzo, now that he's out of station and pretty much, I mean, he still owns stations, but he's on more of an official grounds now with the UFC. He's like a major spokesman now, but still, he doesn't run out and try to get interviews of himself all the time. He's kind of, when an issue comes out, a major issue, he'll come out and talk about it, like the fighter pay thing that ESPN did. For the most part, he's still very reserved. But, you know, you have to understand that these guys put in millions of dollars. I think they lost like $40 million in the first few years trying to get this UFC thing off the ground.
Right.
And people forget that it was a lot of it had to do with their money. And, the whole entire staff that Zuffa has. I mean, Dana's one office in the Zuffa building, but there's a ton of people. Even Joe Silva. I mean, you hardly ever see an interview with that guy. And he does all the matchmaking and works his ass off for that company. And, I mean, I've even heard some inside stories from some people in the business about how they treat him like crap. Give him a shot to really answer a lot of these questions that Dana White goes out there and answers and badmouths the organization. But bottom line is, people just elevate Dana White to the hero status, and they just claim that he revolutionized MMA single-handedly, and he didn't. You know, there was a lot of other people that put the pieces in place. And
well,
number
so
one,
then,
fighters
then,
themselves never get the credit. You know, the whole class of fighters that went out there and fought under those ridiculous rules to begin with and put the sport on the map, they don't get the credit. Dana White gets the credit, who never fought a day in his life.
Well, maybe the question then should be, what has he done recently? In other words, has he outlived his usefulness? Maybe that would be... And I will say that if I'll still get back on that. If it weren't for him, the Fertitta brothers wouldn't have even... had got the reality show on. But we are talking.
There's credit for that. I give him credit for that every time I write anything.
We are talking 7 years. Yeah, we are talking 7 years ago. And so the question is, has his ego grown so big that it's just not appropriate at this point? Because I don't think there's any backstepping with him. I think he's the kind of guy that's pedal to the metal, and he's, you know, that would be my question. That is it time for him to leave and turn it over to someone else? Very good point about Joe Silva. Very good point. You know, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
I don't think he should leave, but, you know, it's kind of like it's too late for that. But in a sense, you know, look how many times he's come out and disciplined fighters for saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. And nobody over his head seems to try to straighten him out. You know, it's like the whole public is so drunk on the fact that he curses and goes out there and says outrageous things and says whatever comes to his mind. And so if they change anything about that, it's like the people that are in love with the guy will suddenly decide he's a scumbag or something. You know, and I think that to an extent, you know, it is good for the business to be a little obnoxious, a little out there, a little in your face. But at the same time, you know, you have to think about where that's holding them back. I mean, people always talk about how much he's done for MMA, but how much has he stunted the growth by being the way he is and not taking the time to really appreciate some of these fighters? I mean, obviously you're giving them bonuses for more exciting fights, you know, fight of the night and stuff like that, and knockout of the night and submission of the night. But why can't, if he's so concerned about the excitement of fights, why can't he come in and decide, all right, well, then we're going to give some huge bonuses just for pure knockouts, pure submissions? You know, if you don't want it to go to the judges, do something about it. Don't just sit there and say it's the fighters, you know.
Yeah.
Or say you're a backer.
I've said this 2.5 years I've been on the show with you, Rich. I've said this 2.5 years I've been on the show with you. If these cards are bringing in so much money and the fighters are not making that much money, yeah, a little bonus here and a little bonus there. But just say, for example, you know, two guys are fighting on the card and it just happens to be headlined by a fight that turns, and I'm going to be talking in boxing terms now, a fight that turns out to be like a Ward Gotti or a Castillo Corrales, a fight that's out of this world. And you put on a good fight, an entertaining fight, and then you're not going to get fight of the night because, you know, shit, look what you just went up against.
Right.
But all these cards are making a shitload of money, and where's it going? It sure as hell is not going to the fighters. I mean, yeah, it's nice to throw a guy a couple $1,000 bonus here and there. Yeah, that is a good thing. But the profits of these cards are not being equally distributed to the fighters. And you look at this. And like I said, I'm not as well versed on MMA as I am in the world of boxing. But take this. We'll go to the heavyweight championship in the world. Vladimir Klitschko just fought. He scored a second stoppage win over Tony Thompson. They fought a couple years ago. Klitschko stopped him. They fought again. Klitschko stopped him again, this time even more convincingly. Now, in the world of, say, UFC, basically, Dana White could blackball Tony Thompson. So, you know what? You just got your ass kicked twice by the champ. So, I'm letting you out of your contract. You're not going to fight the UFC anymore. So, now this guy might, you know, kind of bounce around to smaller leagues, and he might not, you know, ever make the potential money he could make in the UFC. Now, I'm not sure who Tony Thompson's boxing promoter is or who he has a promotional contract with, but just the fact that he lost to Vladimir Klitschko twice does not mean he's never going to get another shot. If he goes back, yeah, I know he's older. I mean, he's not the perfect example to use here. But, yeah, he's older. And let's say he goes back and he can fight and he has a couple more wins. I mean, who's to say that maybe he doesn't get a third fight at Klitschko? Or he doesn't, you know, maybe get a fight at Vitaly Klitschko or Seth Mitchell or another up-and-coming fighter. He's not blackballed out of competing, basically.
All right. Yeah, I just think Dana White's in some kind of dreamland. I mean, it's maybe it's just a matter of because the UFC is where it is, they're on the top of the heap, they can do it the way they want, and they don't have to deal with any consequences because none of the competition is going to be able to catch up because they've pretty much bought it all up. So he's starting to realize now he's in deep water because it's the reality setting in finally that no matter how much money you spend, no matter who you bring into the league, every now and then you're going to get a card that that people are going to complain about. And that's fine if the fans complain. But I think it's, you know, there's a line that you shouldn't cross, complaining about your own events and your own fighters not delivering. Especially when you haven't fought yourself. I mean, it would be a whole different story if Dana came up through MMA himself and then up with this. But he hasn't even had an official amateur boxing match, from what I've read.
Here's the way I can run a parallel to it. About 15 years ago, I'm training down in South Philly, and there was a kid that would come in the gym almost every day. Now, he was never going to compete. He knew he wasn't going to compete. He came there because he really didn't have anywhere else to go. For a kid that was about 17 or 18 years old, he was, and about 5'5", he was about 330 or 340 pounds. You know, and the thing is, he really couldn't do anything. And he would come to the gym, and the trainers were very nice to him. You know, he would just put on a pair of gloves, and he would just hit the bag. He wasn't ripping off combinations. He would just hit the bag in hopes of getting some self-respect for himself and in hopes of losing some weight. And he did very well. And then sometimes he would come up to the ring. He was very quiet, very respectful. I remember one time he had a water bottle, and he just looked at me and he goes, "Hey, would you like a drink?" And I said, "Yeah, sir. Yeah, I would." And then I kind of talked to him a little bit. He was a nice kid. You knew he was never going to compete. Now, he came up to the ring very respectful. He didn't come up to the ring and call me a freaking bum. Or he didn't come up and say all the guys today, you guys are all shit. You guys suck. I saw 10 sparring matches today, and none of you guys impressed me.
It's not like these guys in the UFC go out there and are like, all right, this is the main event fight, you know. I'm going to get a title shot if I win, so I'm just going to go in there and suck it up and do horribly so I don't have to get my title shot, you know. These guys are hungry. They go out there and they try to win. Just because it looks like to some people that, you know, they weren't given 100% or, you know, it wasn't exciting enough for some people, doesn't mean you go out and you say that the whole thing was embarrassing. I mean, what does that guy feel like who's in that main event, you know? Win or lose, you know, those two guys in that main event, that everybody's saying they didn't deliver. Well, you're right, Faber ended up with a broken rib, you know, and how long did he train for that?
Yeah.
Ridiculous amount of time, probably, that he put in to get ready for that fight against a guy who hadn't lost in years, you know, since I think his first professional fight was his only loss. So, just, and all the time, you know, in these other leagues for these guys before they even got to the UFC level. And to turn around and say that's embarrassing. I mean, yeah, maybe the Czech Congo fight deserved those kind of remarks, but not the main event there where it went all five rounds and these guys busted their asses.
Okay, but then let's go back now to the matchmaking. And on paper, all those fights should have been made. And there was that question about Jordan and Congo, and I'll put myself in the matchmaker's shoes, that it was a great fight to be made because Jordan seemed like he was evolving and he knew he had to get a little further, so he went to Jackson's place, you know, and got with a world-class team. And Congo, in spite of what we've said about him, well, you don't know. He can come back. You know, he's been in some exciting fights, and you don't know till you put him in. Now, once you put him in, that's a whole other story, and we still don't know yet about Jordan, and maybe it was the first time, you know, first time of stepping up competition to that. But I mean, you're right. You have to defend the matchmaking, and you can't guarantee the outcome.
To give Dana credit for one thing, he did target the referees in that case, in that fight. The referee that was not breaking the guys up when he should have been. which probably had something to do with it. But you know, you can't force guys to fight when they want to clinch. If that's the way they want to do it, then you know, what are you going to do? You can warn them. You can take a point away, maybe. But if both guys are doing it, that's kind of tough to do. But anyway, let's run through the full results here, and then we'll get to our new segment that we're going to introduce this week. Actually, we got a couple new ones, but we're going to start with this one in a minute. But anyway, we had obviously we talked about Hector Lombard losing to Tim Boach by split decision there. The main event, I did not get to see, but I read that you know, Uriah Faber was just pretty much outclassed. He lost to Renan Pagado. Renan Barao is his nickname. He's 29-1 going in, and Faber had 6 losses and won all 5 rounds. Unanimous decision for Pagado, and he definitely looks like he's going to be a real challenge for Dominick Cruz whenever that fight happens. And so we had Chuck Congo versus Sean Jordan. That was a unanimous decision loss for Jordan. And Eve Levine was the referee there. And Dana White's been pretty critical of him before. I think White has openly said that his favorite referee is Herb Dean. And we actually have Herb's number, but he told me to, actually I met him at an event in Worcester, and he told me to call him. Like, he recruited me to do an interview with him. Which is weird, you know, he's the famous guy. He sees me backstage and he's like, yeah, if you ever want to do an interview, whatever, you know, make sure you text me. So for weeks I tried to get his attention to follow through, and he never responded, so I was just like kind of puzzled. Maybe I'm blacklisted in the UFC for my science stuff, I don't know. But we actually got Bruce Buffer on the show once, so he didn't know about it, so I was surprised that Herb Dean would snub me. That was the case. But anyway, getting back to the fight. Brian Ebersole, we talked about him fighting twice in 1 month. Obviously, it didn't turn out too well for him. He lost to James Head by split decision. And our guest last week lost a pretty tough fight. He was hanging in well with Matt Riddle. But Riddle was just such a natural. I mean, the guy was created by the Ultimate Fighter show. He didn't even have a professional fight before then. And just doesn't even have near the record that Clemens has, and then went out there and really dominated that fight. That's one of the other fights that I did get to watch after the fact. So I actually slept through the preliminaries and all that the night of the fight, so I didn't watch it until the next day. But Riddle cinched a on-the-feet arm triangle choke and tripped Clemens to the ground and finished off 2 minutes into the third round, so definitely a good performance on Riddle's part, and we hope Clemens sticks around and gets another shot. And we had Nick Ring won over Court McGee, and that was a little bit of some controversy there. I don't know if Levine's reffing had anything to do with it, but I did read some stuff about some judging issues with that fight. Some people thought McGee might have won that. And again, I really didn't see it.
Perhaps a little bit of home cooking there, do you think, huh?
Maybe. Francisco Rivera beat Roland Delorme by knockout. That was just towards the end of the first round. Ryan Jimmo got knockout of the night by beating Anthony Perosh in 7 seconds. And that was a fight I did watch, because it was very easy to find. He only had to do 7 seconds worth of video uploading, so
don't blink.
It was just one punch. Just came right off the bell and went. I think it was a right. Just right on the point of the jaw. And we talked about this on the show. There was actually a Harvard study done years ago, and it was in a white collar, white collar brawler it was called. These couple of kids out in California put together, and they brought this guy on from Harvard, who was like a neurological expert. He showed these videos of these monkeys with helmets on, and their heads would just be violently twisted to the right or the left or forward or backwards, and they would just instantly just pass out. And he was explaining that, you know, the reason why they say that, you know, a fighter has a good chin is because that's the best way to knock somebody out, is you hit them on the point of the chin so that their head tilts to the side violently. And that's automatic pass out for most people and most monkeys, obviously. So that's what happened here. Perros just got hit right on the point of the chin, perfect shot, and he was out cold land. It was one of the better knockouts I've seen in a long time. And might have been nice if that was a main event fight. It might have made Dana White a little prouder of his card there. But anyway, we also had Brian Caraway won. Misha Tate's boyfriend, Mitch Gagnon, by rear naked choke. I believe he got the submission of the night for that one. I could be wrong, though. I think it came down to either Matt Riddle or that fight. But I think I read that Caraway ended up with it. Anyway, we also had Antonio Carvalho beat Daniel Pineda by a knockout, also in the first round at the 1 minute and 11 second mark. Then we had Anton Kuvanin beat Mitch Clark by split decision. And that's it. I think the next UFC event's in August, right?
August 4th, I believe.
So we'll talk about that probably next week. Next show will be the 2nd of August, so we'll preview that then. But for right now, we have a special little segment we're going to do. And I was just thinking about this the other day. You guys are both TPs, you know. You both have the same initials, TP, you and Tony. That's kind of a coincidence. But we figured we'd do a little segment called TNT with you guys to get you out in front of our audience a little bit more. Here's our intro song, perfect song for it. Tony, I guess flip a coin, I guess. I don't know.
Well, let me start a clarification, Rich. When we're saying Olympic Dream Team, we are talking about 2012, and we are talking about current American boxers, right?
Yes. Let's go.
So I wouldn't say a guy like Sugar Ray Leonard from the 76 team. I would just say like a guy like today, like a Floyd Mayweather or somebody like that, right?
Well, I don't know. What do you guys think would be better? All time? Like super fantasy dream fights?
I'd say both, actually. I would like to maybe deal with the current crop of fighters, and I'd like to, you know, go with some of the greatest out there of all time that we could potentially use.
All right. Then go with it. Start first there, Tony, since it's your idea to do it that way.
Okay. Well, if I had to pick an Olympic team, like, right now, obviously the number one fighter that I would want to have, I can't use because he is finishing up his prison stint, and we know he's not going to be out or in shape in time for the Olympics. That would have been Floyd Mayweather. I would have liked to have given him a chance to win the gold that he did not get in 1996. So if I could just, you know, run down the super heavyweight, I would have to go with Seth Mitchell right now. Seth Mitchell... up-and-coming fighter. I don't know if he's seasoned enough to fight an Olympic style of boxing, but he's definitely a power puncher. He has a tremendous win over Chaz Witherspoon in his most recent fight. And right now, most of your heavyweights, if you're looking at some of the ranked ones, are, you know, they're not American. They're of a foreign descent. For my 200-pound fighter, I would still go with Philadelphia's own Steve USS Cunningham. He is moving up to heavyweight, but I would put him in the 201-pound division right now. For the light heavyweight, 178-pound division, I would go with Bad Chad Dawson. Very good boxer. He's a southpaw. He knows how to pick his spots. He's got very fast hands. In the super middleweight division, 165 pounds, I would go with the last U.S. fighter to win an Olympic gold medal, and that's Andre Ward. I mean, shit, he's already done it. So if he's already done it once, which is that he can't do it again. In the 156-pound weight class, that's where I would like to use Floyd Mayweather, but obviously we can't do that. So I'm just looking at some of my options right now. Probably
Robert,
he is moving up in weight. When I think of Guerrero, I still always think of him as more of a lightweight. But yeah, Robert Guerrero is moving up in weight. He would be an interesting choice. I would also want to go back to another former Olympian, Vames Matarossian. He's now a professional. He's 32-0 with 20 knockouts. Going to our 147 pounds, I'll tell you who would be a potential good choice just because of his style to win on that stupid point system would be Paulie Malignaggi. Paulie's a current world champion. Not a big puncher, but he has fast hands. He knows how to score. Also, another potential option to look at now that we can't use Floyd Mayweather would be the just recently knocked out Mike Jones. Because Mike Jones is a tall fighter. He has a good jab. He has fast hands. Going down to 140, I would like to give Danny Garcia a shot. Danny should have made it to the team in 2008, and he got screwed over in the qualifiers. I remember following his career out of Philadelphia while he was in the trials for the Olympics, and I remember they were out in Colorado, and the word came back that he got really fucked. So, be honest about it. Now here's where it gets tough, because you start to go down into the lightweight, you're not going to find a lot of big young Americans down there. Going to the lightweight division, I'm going to go with my boy for 132. My boy is fighting tomorrow night on ESPN. Going to go with Hammer and Hank Lundy.
All right.
Well, Hammer out there, he's, when he uses his jab, he can be a force to be reckoned with. Sometimes he just tries to wing power punches. But if Hank was boxing smart, absolutely. And if we don't want to go with Hank, we can go with the guy who just fought last week, who actually Hank just called out, Adrian Broner. Another supremely fast fighter who will be able to pick up and score the points at will. Going down to 125 here, ooh, here's where it's going to get tough. You probably want to go with Mikey Garcia. Mikey Garcia is a good young fighter out of the United States. He's 28-0 with 24 knockouts. We saw him most recently on HBO. I'm trying to stand off. 119. You probably want to go with Abner Mares. He was also another former Olympian, so he has the international experience there. He's got the two wins over Joseph Beckel. And then going down to 112. Right now, off the top of my head, I can't think of any U.S. fighters at 112. I'm even looking at some of the rankings right now, and I can't even find one United States-wise at 112 to even consider.
I will skip that one then. All right, Tom, give us your current flock, unless you have any other ones, Tony. We'll go to the legends afterwards. Tom? Still
oh,
with us?
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, no. Okay, so, well, I've got a few surprises here, okay? In the bigger upper divisions, rather simple, I think, for heavyweight. And since this is so international, I had kind of the same problem that Tony did. You know, you want to start looking at some of the best and some of your favorites, but the Olympics, okay? So we're restricted here. Having said that, I think as long as we could get Cain Velasquez, as long as we could talk him into not fighting for Mexico. Now, I know he might be able to do that. You know, you hear that sometimes. Guys can go back to another country. But as long as Cain's willing to go, he's my choice at heavyweight. Light heavyweight, I think that's an easy one. I'm going with John Jones.
Far and away the favorite there.
Yeah,
sure.
That's not very complicated. And I'm going to jump rank a little bit here when we get down to middleweight, and I'm going with Chris Weidman. I think even though Sonnen is still ranked a little higher, I don't know where Sonnen's going to be at mentally. And I don't even know what division he's going to be in. Too many question marks, and I think that Weidman is the real deal. Now, welterweight was interesting. Here's where I wish we could take alternates. But since I have to go with one, and I've thought about this, Condit, Johnny Hendricks, and I'm going to stick with Carlos Condit, just based on experience and quality of opposition. But I would like Johnny Hendricks along on the plane ride just to be an alternate, if I'm allowed to do that. And now the next two, I'm going to step outside the boundaries a little bit when we get down to lightweight. And this is strictly a stylistic thing. I'm going with Gray Maynard. I believe that if he gets his chance with Benson Henderson, I think we'll have an interesting matchup there. Something tells me that Gray's who I would want. And at featherweight, I'm going to go down the ladder a little bit. I'm very impressed with Eric Koch. Now, I know he's a little below Curran and there's a few others, but with Eric, there's just something about what I've seen with him. He just seems to be the complete package. And as we go to bantamweight, I'll stay with Dominic Cruz. And when we get to flyweight, there's kind of a dearth of Americans even in the top 10, so I'm just out of default. I guess Demetrius Johnson wins that one. And that would be my Olympic matchup. That's my Olympic team.
All right.
There was one spot that I did kind of debate on a minute ago, and I think I'm going to go back on myself here. And I'm taking a little bit of a risk by doing this because the fighter I'm going to select now is past his prime. But I am going to change my pick for light heavyweight, 178 pounds. I originally said Chad Dawson. He's a very good, smooth boxer. He's in his prime, southpaw. You know, he's got a great jab. And that's probably right now, with the way that computer scoring is, that's probably the most important punch you need to win an Olympic gold medal is a jab. That's why guys like Andre Ward were able to do it, and Oscar De La Hoya, they both won it with their jab, with that scoring system. David Reed from Philadelphia, I mean, he was getting badly outclassed, and he landed a counter right hand and knocked Stephen out cold. But I am going to replace bad Chad Dawson, and the reason I'm doing it is because I want to give Roy Jones his chance to win the gold medal that he was robbed of in 1998. Still think, you know, Jones he's well put up the sign, and I don't think he can compete with the top level of professional fighters anymore. But I still think in a three-round fight with his tremendous speed that he could still go out there and win a gold medal. And I think he still deserves that after, you know, what happened in 1998.
Well, I would say if there's a sentimental reason to change any of Tom's choices, I think I would go with Brian Stann at middleweight just to give a soldier a chance to win a gold medal. That would be nice. But let's go with the legends now, of all time.
Okay, so how we're going boxing-wise. Heavyweight, I'm looking at some of the great heavyweights, super heavyweights, I should say, that we had out there from the United States. You know, we had a great battle out there as a silver medalist in 1998. But probably the heavyweight legend, super heavyweight legend I would go with would be the big man himself, Big George Foreman. He was an Olympic gold medalist in 1968. Was a stoppage win. Very impressive. Going back on to heavyweight, we had some very good fighters there. We had Merciless Ray Mercer, former guest on our show, who was a gold medalist. Heavyweight, it would be difficult with the scoring the way it is today. With the scoring the way it is today, I don't think the fighter I'm going to pick would have as good of a chance as he did in 1964. But I want to go with the late great Smokey Joe Frazier. He was the champion in 1964, the gold medalist, class act, all the way. One of the greatest heavyweight champions of all time. So I'm going to go with Smokey Joe heavyweight. Like I said, I don't know if his style is conducive to the modern day Olympics, but let's just hop a Smokey Chance anyway. We also have the Spinks brothers in there, very impressive fighters. At light heavyweight, I thought about, Michael Spinks. I thought about Roy Jones. I thought about, the other fighters. But how can you possibly overlook the 1960 Olympic gold medalist in Cassius Clay? We know him a little bit better as his name as a professional, Muhammad Ali. You really can't. You can't overlook that guy. Going down to 165 pounds, also had, you had guys like, Floyd Patterson out there, a very impressive fighter. Trying to think, who would I go with? You had Floyd out there, another heavyweight, another fighter that tremendously fast hands, good power. I think you'd have to go with him at 156. Going down, 156. Now I'm confusing myself. 165, I'm sorry. Going down to 156, I think that's where you'd want to go with a primary Jones back in 1988. I mean, he was unbelievable. 147, you had another great fighter out there, and guys like Mark Breland, who was a tremendous, tremendous, weight out there. But how can you look past Ray Charles Leonard? Gotta go with the great Sugar Ray. I mean, he was amazing when he was in the Olympics. They said he was so scared going into his final match that he'd take the picture of his girlfriend with his ankle just because he didn't want to go into the ring alone. And he pulled that play apart. As you go in the lower weight classes, you get down to, 139 pounds. He was trying to think some of the great fighters he's had out there. I was always a big fan out of another Philadelphia competitor. His first year was too short, but it was sure as hell it shined bright when he was, a pro, Melvin Taylor. Going down to 132. Once again, going back to the class of 84, it was a great class. You had a guy like Pernell Whitaker.